to Artery, to Robert Simpkins, a podcast on art, authorship, and anthropology. In each episode of this collaborative podcast, one anthropologist, specializing in a particular cultural context, has a conversation with an artist of their choosing, exploring issues of authorship and relational creativity in art. In this episode, Fatema Albastaki, a researcher studying dance and movement, speaks with Mike Williams, a CELAT martial artist. I will now hand over to Fatema, who will introduce herself and her guest.
Hello, and welcome to this conversation between myself, Fatema Albastaki, and Mike Williams. To introduce myself, I'm currently an independent researcher and master's graduate of the Coriamundus program, which specializes in anthropology of dance and movement. For my thesis, I worked on a study of a Southeast Asian martial arts called Penchak Silat and did my fieldwork in Vienna, Austria. I learned a lot from the Silat network in Europe and met Johnny Silman, founder of the organization called The Way, which stands for Warrior Arts of Indonesia. I became interested in the artistic aspects of Silat, so it was through him that I was introduced to Mike Williams. Mike is a Silat martial artist, teacher, and performer. He is the founder of West Kent Silat Padepokan in the UK, which specializes in at least 5 styles of Silat. He gives seminars, brings teachers, and travels annually to West Java, Indonesia. We will be talking about Penchak Silat, his experience as a martial artist and performer. So Mike, feel free to tell us more about yourself to our listeners.
Oh, okay. So I've been involved in martial arts all my life, from the usual sort of judo and karate stuff as a child and teenager. Then eventually went to boxing and Muay Thai, which is from obviously from Thailand, then some Eskrima from the Philippines. And then in 92, I was able to find Silat, first Malaysian Silat, and then Sumatran Silat, which I've studied for over 30 years. So Sumatran Silek is their terminology for it. And from there, obviously, traveled to Sumatra and Malaysia a lot, but then also to Java, where my love affair with the West Javanese Penchak Silat styles began. And I've trained ever since. As you said, sort of visiting every year, if not sometimes twice a year, bringing teachers over, meeting them whenever they're in Europe, and just practicing relentlessly for an art that I love, that covers everything from upright fighting to ground fighting to breaks to locks to every form of weapon. But the beauty of it is, which is probably what we'll get into, is that it's a movement-based martial art rather than a technique-based martial art.
So can you tell our listeners more about this movement system, Penchak Silat, and why it's important, how these styles relate to the art?
So Penchak Silat. So Penchak relates to basically the movement that you practice in forms which we call jurus, or within the dance that we call Ibingan. And from that, I'm talking about West Javanese or Sundanese martial arts. So you practice the movements until they become part of your muscle memory. And each movement has been in many applications, both at defensive, offensive, counters, all sorts of things. So rather than some arts which get you to practice and learn by rote techniques and how to respond to certain techniques, which relies on your brain, if you learn Silat properly, it relies on your nervous system and your muscle memory, which is less likely to fail you in the event of a fight. And a lot of the training, including the Ibing, is there effectively to make sure it's really embedded in you. And as a result, when you're practicing with a student or fighting, you rarely do the same thing twice, but you use different movements. So Penchak relates to the movement, whereas Silat relates to the use of that movement for the purposes of self-defense. And in Java, I believe they're very, very good at it, from the different styles, like Chimande, which is one of the grandfather type arts of Java, through Chikalong, which is a softer style. Chimande is fairly hard, but quite balanced in between hard and soft applications and use of movement. Chikalong is a bit softer, Serra's a bit harder. And the other style that I know is Panglipur, which is an amalgam style. It's a synthesis style which has seven or eight different styles from West Java in it, put together by a very clever man that mastered them all and looked for synergies within them. So it's a very complex style to learn, takes many years, but encompasses pretty much most of what you'd find in West Java.
Going back just a little bit, and this highlighting this importance of inputting the jurus into your muscle memory, like how long into your experience did you feel like, okay, this is something that I'm embodying and I want to continue going in depth with?
Yeah, well, I think because Silat in West Java is so vast, one of the things that draws me to it all the time is there's no end to it. It's not like you're ever going to get to the end and get a black belt and think, oh, I've achieved this. All of my teachers, who are phenomenally skilled and talented individuals that have been practicing for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. I mean, one of my teachers is 87, so he's been practicing for nearly 80 years. When none of them cease practicing, they continue to practice because there's always more to learn and more to master. But like with everything, the more you practice particular movements and the way that you're taught is to practice movements right, practice them left, practice them going forward, going sideways, going backwards, till all the movement become instinctive. But it's a lot of repetition and takes a lot of time and takes a lot of dedication to do it. Because even some of the simplest movements, if you did them in all the various footwork patterns, you'd be talking about maybe 180, 190 repetitions just to do them, you know, one simple juru, left and right in all the various footwork patterns. But by the time you've done that, it is definitely within you. It becomes more complex, of course, when you start getting into jurus with 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 movements. Takes longer. But the movements aren't necessarily new movements. They're just in different orders.
Okay. So there's not necessarily a black belt. There's no grading system in Silat. But can you tell me more about that connection with your teachers and the lineage that you follow?
Yeah.
And when do they give you that?
Well, it's what I like about it is the West can become quite focused about belts and gradings and getting a certain achievements by certain levels. And that's very often because money's brought into the equation. Whereas if you go to somewhere like West Java, where there's a village Padpakans, which is schools, they're just there as for the benefit of the community, and everybody goes there from sort of 3, 4, 5 years old to old men. People turn up, train and practice. And what's great about it is if you're there and you see somebody performing a juru or using weapons in a way on a juru that you don't know yet, then you ask them to show you. Now, sometimes those people are much older than you, sometimes they're younger than you. So it's a great art with no ego, which is wonderful. So long as you go with an open heart and an open mind and willingness to learn and to share. And obviously the same thing happens to me sometimes when I'm there and performing something. One of the people, junior students, will come to me and say, well, you know, can you show that or do that again? But my teachers are very generous with their time and their training, Gendin Rasbuzi, Kang Chichep Arif Rahman, Abaraziz Azileri. They teach me Jiman Desera, two styles of Panglipur and Chikalong and Sarah. So I think I'm off to Chikalong really. But you basically practice and you practice and you practice until they are happy that you understand the movement, you have the movement within you, and you understand some of the potential applications and defenses that would come from it. They don't teach you all of them because that's sort of impossible, because you could spend months and months and months just on a few different movements. So you learn some and you're expected to find and understand the rest yourself, but also how to translate those to weapons. And your teachers will then check that and check that understanding to make sure that you've got it, so that when, like in my instance, when I go and teach my small number of students, they know and I know that I'm passing on a genuine art in the way that I've learned it. Because it'd be all too easy for me to come and simplify it and change things for the Western mind. But then you start to lose something then in the translation.
Tell us the process of like how your teacher grants you authorship to start teaching students here.
Well, you know? I think sort of back to what I've just said, really. I think you've got to show the authentic teachers in West Java that you're serious. And you do that, and I've done that by having a long association with them, returning to Java many times, hosting them, and showing that not only do I, when I'm there and they're teaching me things, I make comprehensive notes, I take short videos, but mostly my notes. I've got two very thick notebooks, which have all my learning for the last 25 years in there. So, A, they know they'll have an accurate record of what the movement or the applications should be. But once they know you're generous and you genuine, sorry, and you practice hard and can repeat it in front of not only them but other students or other teachers and demonstrate applications for it, once they're happy that you understand it, and they're happy that you would keep to the syllabus, then they give you the authority and the authorship to go and teach it. And sometimes they'll see some of my teachers, some of my students. So they're able to see some of my students repeat or do movements and applications and see how well I've been able to pass that across. So I think that's the main way for them to make sure that you're genuine and authentic in your willingness and ability to learn what they're teaching you, be able to pass it on as well, because it's an heirloom. It is their heirloom, so you know you have to look after it.
Okay, and when it comes to your teaching style, how do you follow exactly how your teachers have taught you, or
I'm still very focused on people understanding the movement and getting it in their muscle memory first before I start wading into all the various applications, because it can also be overwhelming when you start to show how many things can come from one movement. People can become overwhelmed with that. So it happens over a period of time. I've students, my current crop of students have been with me anywhere up to sort of 8 years, and they're still progressing through the curriculum and understanding it. So it's different, but primarily I teach so I can become better as a martial artist, because one of the great sayings is you learn through teaching, and I've learned an awful lot through teaching and showing and demonstrating to people that maybe I didn't quite understand when I first learned it myself. So that's my primary reason to do it, alongside my love of Silat. But you know, it is always nice to really better pass something on. And ideally, I'd like my students to be able to continue in the future and then teach their own students.
Yeah, it's nice to hear that teaching Sila can also show you another depth to your training, I think.
Yeah. And it's interesting as well. Also, it's interesting having numerous students, because I've lost count of the amount of times that actually one of my teachers has told me something and demonstrated something which has resonated and I've finally got it, even though another one of my teachers has probably already said or done that with me before. But maybe the first time it didn't go in. But another teacher sometimes doing it makes something click in your head, thinking, ah, oh, I now know why I'm doing that. Whereas maybe you didn't quite get it or maybe thought you'd got it before, but interestingly, after the other teacher does it, you then suddenly think, oh, now I do get it. So it's fascinating. And the same things happened through my teaching. As I've taught various things, movements and applications and principles and subtleties, because a lot of it's around feeling. It's amazing what you start to realize when you're teaching and demonstrating and showing something that again, as I say, maybe you didn't recognize first go round.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you like bring this up, because I think I've been told by a lot of my interlocutors that the pedagogical context is different. So you playing the role as a student and a teacher in those two different contexts can, I think, bring up different things. But
yeah,
ultimately, I think what you say is interesting about this feeling, about feeling, you know, yeah. How many drills does it take to feel this?
That's right. And everyone's different,
mm-hmm.
you know, and everybody's body shape's different. Everybody's natural ability is different. You know, the way people process and learn information and learn and take things on is different. So it's fascinating, really. Sometimes you can show something to people the same amount of times and demonstrate, and somebody gets it straight away. Somebody might take weeks to get it.
Have you taken any of your students to Indonesia or?
Yeah, in the past, yeah. And I'd like to take some of the people that currently learn. But I often bring my teachers over, actually. One of my teachers, Abagendin Rasputi, is over with me next week. So all my students will get to see him and train with him for about 12 or 13 hours over a week. So it's great for them, but for them to see my teachers and see where my knowledge comes from. You know, it's also good for them to see that, you know, I've got nothing to hide. So I'm very, very happy for any of my students to train with any of my teachers, or in fact, anybody else.
Why do you think it's important to connect these worlds?
Because it comes to lineage, you see, because without lineage, or in Silat, we call it a silsila. Which is the lineage, which is the named line lineage through all your teachers back to basically the source. So it's their guarantee of authenticity and accuracy, the fact everybody can name up through their various teaching line, you know, back hundreds of years. The silsila I have with my teachers on it is a huge piece of paper which goes back to the, you know, late 1600s, you know, 1600s. And it probably goes back farther than that. But obviously, I don't think the written records were, it was more of a verbal record rather than a written record. But it's nice to have that, because, again, when you go to Indonesia and as a Westerner, and if you talk to somebody and you say, oh, you do, you practice Pencak Silat, first thing they'll say is what style, or what Aliran is generally what they say, but who is your teacher and who's your teacher's teacher? So they straight away, they want to know what have you learned and who's teaching you, because they want to know, you know, is it correct? Is it accurate? Are you doing it properly?
Mm-hmm.
So having that silsila, that chain, that link all the way through is very important. I think, and all my students have a copy of my silsila, so they can see themselves where my various lineage lines for the different styles all go to, and they all track back to generally the originator of the style.
Would you say that in Bingan, you know, is that a typical trajectory for training Silat? Like, is that?
Yes, yeah. I mean, eventually, because to do Ibingan well, all the movements must be in you. So when you perform, you're doing variations of jurus or extensions of jurus or linking various jurus together, sometimes hundreds and hundreds of movements. So you need to have those in your muscle memory and be able to do them without thinking on what comes next. So it's a very good way of practicing, and people would have you believe that Ibbingen evolved so that the Sundanese could practice their martial arts without it being obvious, when they were controlled by the Dutch, and obviously the British were there at some stage, and the Japanese all banned use and practice of martial arts. So there's a school of thinking which says that Ibbingen really came into its own as a way to practice in plain sight under the authorities that were controlling you. But you need to be able to do it really well in terms of the movements before you even start to link it to music. Because the Ibbingen has various sections within it, and it has a beat which will keep going. And obviously, if you fall behind that beat or you start to get it wrong, then really it will look a mess.
Okay. So we've talked a lot about your teaching experience in Sialat and your training. I'm curious to know about yourself as a performer, Sialat performer.
I often train the Ibbings with my teachers, sometimes just the two of us, sometimes with another senior student or some students. We'll get the music, or if the gamelan band is there, or we'll do it to recordings. It's very hard, actually. I practice to recordings, which are unyielding, because obviously the recording of the music just keeps going whether you like it or not. Whereas to a degree, if you do it to a live gamelan band, they will tweak their timings a bit for the various beats to go with you, so they can help you a bit if you're a little bit off time. But if doing it to a recording is a great way to practice, because it makes you be very accurate and precise with your breathing and your timing, hitting the marks of the beat. There's three sections to an Ibbing. The first section is a type of beat known as either Palaradan or Tepak Dua. And that generally has a beat of seven beats between gongs. And within those sections, you'll either do maybe six movements or seven movements or eight movements. Sometimes there's a movement that has two beats. Sometimes there's two movements to a beat, depending on the type of thing you're doing. So the first section is either done to Palaradan or Tepak Dua. That then morphs into the second type of beat called Tepak Tilu, which is generally recurring beats of four. And then that morphs at the end to a beat called Padungdung, which basically is a fast beat, and it will just go at whatever speed you do. And the way it's always been explained to me is that the first section, either the Tepak Dua or the Palaradam, is very graceful, relatively slow, beautifully and artistically done to show the beauty of the Penchak Silat movements. The Tepak Tilu is a bit faster, a bit tighter, and more application based, showing actually you can perform the movements at a faster speed, technically correct, whereas Padungdung is basically fighting speed with a broken rhythm. So you'd be expected to do everything in a at fighting speed, but also put the pauses in there for whatever the your imaginary opponent's reactions might be. So it's fascinating, and you can do those e-bings. I mean, the shortest one I know is 2.5 minutes long. The longest one I know is nearly 12 minutes, which is, I've never counted, but that's got to be over 600 movements. Which takes, you know, it takes some practice. And as well, they can all be done empty hand, or they can be done with various weapons. You can do the first section empty hand, maybe the second section with a go lock, maybe the third section with two go locks or a different weapon or whatever. So it's you start to get some freedoms as to how you do it and how you interpret it, as long as you understand the makeup of what needs to be within an e-bing. So that's normally a full e-bing, which is, I say, the first beat of Palaradan or Tepak Dua, second beat of Tepak Tilu, third beat of Padungdung. But also you can sometimes performers just go straight up and just do Tepak Tilu or just do Padungdung, and the gamelan band will recognize immediately what's happening and set the beat and keep pace with the performer's movements. Mm-hmm. So it is fantastic to see, because you see some people perform it in, you know, a quite light-hearted way. Some people perform it in a very technical way. Some people can perform it in a fast and aggressive way. So it's fascinating to see what comes out in the different characters of the performers.
Yes, I think it's really beautiful how actually extremely technical it is, like the three sections.
Yeah.
And how rich of a practice it is. I think it's not widely known in the West that it...
No. Well, a lot of people poo-poo it or just put it down as dance and it has no purpose and what a waste of time. And you know, all those comments come from ignorance, truly, where they don't understand and they've never learned properly, or they've had sort of teachers that have never learned Silat properly, but who purport to teach Silat. And as a result of not learning it themselves, they poo-poo it to their students. But it's incredibly hard to do well. And believe me, I am no expert at it in any way, shape or form. You wouldn't sort of pay money to see me perform. I'm not a natural performer, where some of the people are, but I love the practice of it. I love the principle of it. It's quite pressured, because you're having to keep to time, you're having to keep to the beat, you're having to translate your movements accurately to the beat, and you've got to keep control of your breath. So in some respects, they also class it as a way to practice controlling your nerves and your breath for fighting. So, mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot in it. I think it needs to be respected very highly as such.
Right. And can you talk about this relationship, this importance of Silat as well with music with Silat?
Yeah, well, I think it's all part of they've got a really, really strong culture and sense of self, a thing that maybe a lot of us have lost in the West, their culture with their music, their martial arts and their performances, whether it's Wayang Golek, which is the shadow puppets, or whether it's the ancient Sundanese dance, or whether it's the performance of Penchak Silat, it's all totally integrated in their community. You know, weddings, funerals, any major events, you'll see all those forms of practice. And you normally find the very good teachers, including all of mine, either play within gamelan bands or can play all the instruments. Some of them can do the shadow puppets, which is really good for hand and finger dexterity. You know, some can do Sundanese singing. And so they're all interlinked, which is absolutely fascinating to see.
I'm curious about, like, how the internal process is for you when you experience and express that feeling in movement during the performance.
Yeah, well, I think you have to definitely feel the music. I try and sort of in my own little way, try and become Sundanese as much as I can in the way I practice Masila and the music, because it's not a natural beat. The gamelan music isn't a natural beat to the Western ear. So when you first hear it, it just seems like a lot of people playing random instruments at the same time. But it takes a while before you start to actually see through the mist of the tune to what the underlying beats are. Because there's also sub-beats within it. There's things like, there's a little beat called Baragbag, where after a gong, sometimes if you do like a very slow sweeping movement before you come into something, the band will see that and do this sort of build-up music before it starts to do the next gong. So it is fascinating, but a lot of it I get from watching people and obviously learning through my teachers. But I've got a long way to go yet before I'm anywhere near their standard, if obviously that's ever achievable.
So when you perform with the group and the gamelan band, is that something you plan? Do you have a choreographic performance planned before you go ahead and perform it?
Yeah, depends.
Collaboration work.
Yeah, it depends on the teacher. Certainly, I like to practice. If I know I'm going to do one, then I practice it and I go through the all the movements. And just to remind myself, because sometimes obviously you can get lost from one ebing to the next or one juru to the next. So I like to rehearse myself. Sometimes my teacher doesn't give me any time to rehearse. They'll just say, let's just do it. Depends on the character of the teacher, really. If they're happy that in their own mind that you know it, then they'll just do it. But one of my teachers, Kangchiche Parivraman, he has a large school and they do a lot of performances. He has a lot of younger students in their late teens, early 20s, and they practice a lot before they do a performance to a large audience. So it's always nice when they're there and they're practicing for a large performance, I'll join in with their practice.
Is there a flexibility to spontaneously improvise your own movements and create your own movement?
Yes. I think when you're really good, because what matters is that you keep to the count. So sometimes I see my teachers, they'll sort of go off piste a bit, but they'll still keep to the same count. But instead of maybe one particular technique, they'll put another one in. Or they'll do them a different order, but it'll still keep to the beat or it'll still work. But really where the real freedom comes is in the last section, in the padungdung, which literally is your ability to do anything you want free. But this is where people get confused as well, because when you say do anything you want, that's not just to make up a load of movements. It's to do specific sila technique movements, but in a different order than you would normally see.
Okay, so there's not only this codependent relationship with the Silat performer and the band, but also to the beat of the music as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also you find as well, normally there's a master of ceremonies, or there's the male singer for the gamelan band, can often get the crowd really excited by shouting hoos and ha's whenever the performer does something with gusto or with power or something really impressive. And very often you normally get a situation, if somebody does something really graceful or really precise and accurate, the crowd normally starts clapping anyway throughout various sections. But normally the master of ceremonies will can get everybody pumped up as well. As the performer really gets into it and starts putting some energy and effort into their techniques.
Wow. And during the performance, there's also a group that leads, or you can lead, or the music leads, or basically there's a leader and a follower,
yes,
right?
Yes. And predominantly it's gamelan band that leads the beat, but the performer obviously starts it off. So when the performer starts, there's a normal warm up, which is the prayer and the opening section. But then the band will recognise that once that's been done, the band will recognise the performer is going to start. And sometimes the performer will keep like a steady beat and steady count of seven beats, for example, on the first section between the gongs. Sometimes they'll do them in a broken rhythm, but that's where the band will change and adapt. But it is interesting and how the band can change from one type of beat to the other in conjunction with the performer. But very often when the performer at the end, towards the end of the middle section, which is called Tepak Tilu, before the performer transitions into Pudungdung, as it's building towards the end of Tepak Tilu, starts to get faster. So the four-beat pattern starts to become really fast towards the end, and the performer will often shout out "Hoop!" or some, you know, make some large noise, which tells the band he's about to start going into Pudungdung.
Hmm.
So it's very symbiotic. But for them, it's natural because, you know, they've all grown up with it. And as I've said, a lot of the performers are expert musicians in gamelan band, so they understand it, you know, at a cellular level. Whereas I still have to, like many Westerners, have to process it through my brain.
Everything is symbiotic with each other, and this also could include the influence of the observers, not only the artist, the group, and the band.
Yeah, yeah.
What would you say is this relationship, this connection between the observers, the audience?
Well, I think they're all involved in it because the audience primarily understands all the movements that you're doing. So they're watching, A, to see how good you are at doing it and if you're doing them precisely, but also out of appreciation. And, you know, they can recognise themselves then, you know, when they're seeing it being done well, and that's where you often get the claps from. You know, they join in with the cheering, they're enjoying the music of the band and the performer. So realistically, for an Ibingan to go really well, it needs the performer, it needs the band, and it needs a knowledgeable and committed audience.
Okay, so they also contribute to the beat with their claps.
Yeah, and the cheers and, you know, the claps and, you know, the shouts of appreciation, like with anything, which obviously gives the performer even more sort of desire and impetus to perform. You know, they're not just performing to this empty gallery that's silent, and then they're not performing and getting zero feedback. They're actually performing and they're getting lots of feedback.
I want to know, do you just exclusively perform in Indonesia?
Yes, I do. Because, like I said, I'm not an extrovert. I don't look for opportunities to go and perform in public. My art's quite private, really, for me. I'm quite low key with it. I don't advertise my school. I don't advertise for students. I don't go looking for people. I don't do it for a living. And very often I choose not to teach people. So I like to keep myself to myself with it a lot. But apart from that, you know, trying to find a gamelan band that will perform and an opportunity to do it, you know, it's quite a lot of hard work in the West, whereas, you know, when I'm in West Java, pretty much all the schools have a gamelan band, and it's no effort, and it's a natural thing just to do it.
Why do you think there's this gap or lack of Silat artistic performances in the West?
Oh, because most people have never learned all the movements. They don't understand it. Because to learn, you know, some of these things takes, you know, I'm sure one of the Ibings has probably taken me about 2.5 years to learn. the longest one. I mean, it's no simple task.
Do you feel the difference of like performing it? Because it, often there's this phenomenon about performing it on the land itself, yeah. You know, and that feeling yeah. of being on the land.
Yeah.
So do you feel that difference?
Yes, definitely. And also when I'm practicing as well, and very often with my teachers, we won't just stay in the padapakam, we'll go outside into the forest, into the rice fields, barefooted, get the red earth of Western Java in your feet, and you just become connected to it. I try and walk around with bare feet all the time when I'm there. I absolutely adore being there. It from all the noise to the heat and the humidity, the afternoon rains, the calls to prayer. You know, it's a real sensory delight.
I think we'd be closing soon, but I guess I'd want to know, how has this art in itself, like, it's not just a martial art, it's not just a dance, it's all encompassing, it has many elements.
Yeah.
How has it really influenced your life? And
massively. I always feel like I've always done it. So I practice every day. I think about it a lot. I talk to my teachers regularly. I see them regularly. I read my notes sometimes when I'm waiting at the in the car at the school gates for pickup. I'll always have my notebooks with me, and I'll pick through and I'll look at something I've not done for a while and reread it. You know, I read my notebooks in bed. It's just a part of me. It's not a chore. It's just I'm just constantly trying to understand it more and more.
Well, Mike, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk to you and learn about your experience with Silat.
Thank you.
This was Artery with Robert Simpkins, a podcast on art, authorship and anthropology, supported by the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council. Hope to speak with you again soon.